today we, pardon me, I'm still a little ill, so my voice is in an unusual register. Today we commemorate the death of Shakyamuni Buddha, his parinirvana. So we'll have a little ceremony after the talk, and you're all welcome to stay. It'll be short, so. Shakyamuni's great teaching, of course, has to do with reality. And in particular, the reality of the person. And the fruition of all of his great practice effort was, or is, to see that something like a person as process, not as entity. And observing the world or reality in the midst of that unfolding truth is, it's zazen, and it's also liberation. We may still think of zazen as something that leads to liberation. We may still think that because, well, it's one of those things you hear. If you practice, you will attain liberation. But this is thought to be a rather narrow view. After all, there really isn't anyone to attain liberation. And liberation itself is a kind of a fiction. Instead, to see and indeed experience the person as process is ongoing liberation. Finally, that understanding and will encompass others and also things. What we encounter, what we conjure as objects in the universe are also process and inseparable from the process that we label person. So in this neck of the woods, anyway, the practice is to align our life, to live our life in accord with this compelling and quite radical view of reality. Now it's a little eerie, I guess you could say. During my illness, which wasn't too severe, more annoying than anything else, I was trying to remind myself to, so to say, sit zazen while lying in bed or coughing my head off or whatever I was doing. That is, to surrender the view of person as entity and to let that be supplanted by the actual experience of person as process, life as process, reality as process. This is a good practice, and my notion is that as Shakyamuni approached his own demise, he was practicing in a similar way. I was reading in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Pali text version of the Nirvana story, the Nirvana Sutra. There are all kinds of teachings in there, all sorts of anecdotes and lists and quotable quotes and so forth. Sometime before his demise, Shakyamuni was invited by a celebrated courtesan named Ambapali, who, as you may know, became an arhat and one of Buddha's disciples. But at this point, she was still a courtesan and presumably entertaining clients in her luxuriously appointed house. But when she invited Buddha and the monks to dinner, he didn't say anything, which was evidently how they said yes. So someone would say, "Oh, blessed one, come on over to dinner," and he wouldn't say anything. That apparently meant yes. So she said, "Come on to dinner and bring your monks," and he did say anything. So sure enough, he showed up at dinner. But before that, it's an amusing scene where Ambapali, the famous courtesan, is leaving, and in comes this whole kind of small riot of young folks. I envision the teenagers of the time. These are the Lichavi clan, and the sutra says they were elaborately dressed, and some wore blue makeup, and some white, and some red. So they're evidently all got up. And they came roaring in on their various chariots or conveyances, making a great ruckus. And they went running up to Buddha and said, "Hey, come on over to dinner tomorrow." And he said, "She just invited me. So I have to go to her place tomorrow." And then they all snapped their fingers and said, "Ambapali, the mango woman, has beaten us." But they also laughed uproariously. So this sounded like a fun-loving crew of teenagers who also wanted to hear Buddha. Maybe he went to visit them on another occasion. But anyway, he does go to dinner at Ambapali's house, and that night after he gets back, he's very sick. And he realizes that he has, as it says in the sutra, he has renounced the life principle. Namely, his, you might say, intention to go on living, he has surrendered. There's another story in that sutra, which I've mentioned before, where he tries several times to drop some hints to his beloved attendant, Ananda, that if somebody would just ask him, he could probably live to be 100 because he has mastered these various powers. And poor Ananda just nods and smiles. "Oh, that's cool." So then he tries again. "Ananda, you know, if someone were to ask the Blessed One, he could probably live to be 100. "Oh, very great." So, and this is like 3 times. And finally he says, "You know, never mind." And later on, when he's speaking of having renounced the life principle, which he does subsequent to this little chat with Ananda, and and Mara, the evil one, so-called, comes and says, "Okay, you should die now." And Shakyamuni says, "You know, keep your shirt on. I will die in 3 months." So Mara is satisfied with that. But later he tells Ananda, I have renounced the life principle. And Ananda goes, oh wait, no, Blessed One, please live to be 100. And Blessed One says, you had your chance. And then he relates, like, not just that prior occasion, but several prior occasions where he brought this up. And every time Ananda just goes, oh, yeah, neat. And finally, Ananda gets around to asking, and it's too late because Blessed One has renounced the life principle. So anyway, having done that, he feels this illness after dining with Ambapali, and he realizes, this is the approach of the demise, the great Amha Parinirvana. So at that point, he and Ananda and the monks travel all around all these various places that he's visited before and give talks. And almost every place he goes, he addressed the assembled people and said, O worthy people, this is upright conduct. And he talked about upright conduct. And this is concentrated practice. And he talked about concentration or sitting. And he said, and this is wisdom. We talk about wisdom. This famous threefold division of Buddhist practice: upright conduct, concentration, and wisdom. So he'd talk about that in almost all of these places. There's also a very interesting scene where he comes to a river which was running quite fast at that time, the Ganges, as a matter of fact. And so there were a bunch of people around, and they were like looking for boats and ferry boats to get across. And all of a sudden, in the twinkling of an eye, Shakyamuni and all the monks are on the other side. And Shakyamuni says, those folks over there are running around looking for boats, but the wise have already crossed over. I thought, that's cute. That's almost a Zen thing. The wise have already crossed the river. The wise meaning basically all beings. And then the wise live that way. The wise live in that truth, and thus are already across the river. This is not to say that there is not work to be done, because there clearly is. And even when Shakyamuni actually came to die, he did his little meditation on using the various trance states that he'd learned about in his early practice life after he left his palace. Learned about some, what Edward Kanza called transic concentration. So he did some of that. But then he descends, right before he dies, he descends from the highest trance to one of the lower trances, interestingly enough, and chooses to exit this life from one of the lower concentrations. And as you know, his last teaching was the one about how you should be a lamp unto yourself. The actual word used, vipa or dipa in Pali, could also mean island. And I was gratified that the translator, Morris Walsh, in this case, advises us not to try to nail down which one it was, because there's really no way to tell. But both suggest that the locus of our effort, even though it includes everyone else and everything, is here. Buddha says, don't put another head on top of yours, even mine. Don't walk around with a Buddha head floating above you. Like, if I could only get up there, my head would be full of wisdom. He advised all of us not to do that, but to be your own light. Now, everybody's light, as we know, is not strictly purely individual. So when he says, be your own light, he's talking about being our light. Let us be a light unto ourselves. Let our own practice, our own effort, illuminate this process and all process. Illuminate all entities, all objects. This again is Zazen. This is the the cultivation of just sitting. The enactment, the embodiment of just process. No particular person, no particular agenda, no particular burden, just this now. And this resonates as truth, as the way things actually are. And the more we contemplate life from this vantage point, the more the unity of practice and liberation becomes evident, and the less tendency we have to try and hang on, to try and dig in our heels. Although it's very tempting, I have to admit. But of course, it avails us nothing. In this Mahaparinibbana Sutta, there's also this celebrated list of the 37 factors of enlightenment. Do you know about those? That's one of those cool lists that's probably good for Buddhists to know. I actually noticed that I'd forgotten a bunch of them, so I won't try to recite it. But they're all things that occur in other contexts. But starting with the foundations of mindfulness, and the four right efforts, and then various other things, which I keep forgetting. Oh, the Eightfold Path is in there. The 10 faculties, which are kind of paired with the five faculties and the five powers, which are kind of paired together. That's another very famous list. Faith or trust, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. These are regarded as five faculties, and when they are fully cultivated, they become the five powers. So that's another 10 of these 37. If one wants to equip oneself Buddhistically to be a Buddhist in the world, that's a good list. The 37 factors of enlightenment are good. That includes the Eightfold Path, by the way. So if you got Four Noble Truths, 12-fold chain of dependent origination, and the 37 factors of enlightenment, you don't need a whole lot more. That's that's Buddhism 101. You can carry that around with you and study and reflect on it. That's a lifetime of reflection right there, just those few lists. Now, of course, when Shakyamuni died, there was some concern that, what's going to happen to all of this great thing that you started? And Buddha said, well, no, don't worry about that. I've given you Dharma. I've given you Vinaya, that is, guidelines for upright conduct. And you have Sangha right here. So he said, now, if someone wants to step forward and say, I am the new leader of the Sangha, let him do so, or her. But no one did. Also, when Mara came and said to Buddha, you know, you should die now, Buddha said, actually, when Shakyamuni woke up, Mara appeared and said, okay, you're done, you should get out of here. Shortly after his awakening, and Shakyamuni said, no, I am not going anywhere until I have established practice for monks and nuns and laymen and laywomen. So at least in this version, he's thinking from the outset about everyone practicing, all genders, all people. And this controversy about when women could be admitted to the order, it's kind of another angle on it. But right at first he was saying, I will not pass away until I have established practice for these four great groups, which to this day is known as the Fourfold Assembly. The ordained women and men, and householder, women and men. So, so today we can kind of bid farewell to Shakyamuni as process, and in so doing, fulfill in a gentle way this Zen suggestion that if you meet Buddha, kill Buddha. Which is really, it's no different from when Buddha said, be your own light. Don't wait for Buddha to come along to be your light. And somehow when I got to China, it came out sounding like, when you meet Buddha, kill Buddha, which is a little more arresting. But then, that was part of the Chinese genius. Let's shake the apple cart here and see what falls off. But it's basically the same thing, the same teaching. Don't put another head on top of your head. Don't try to adorn your process any more than it already is. Endlessly fascinating, endlessly complex, endlessly mysterious. Just sit there, watch, receive this self that is constantly being given and is made up of happening. No fixed Lego blocks that stick together, just happening. And if we practice in this way, then we are on Shakyamuni's path. And in a sense, his passing away was a kind of non-event, because he still lives in this process and in this practice. Ideally, you know, some part of our mind, some part of our effort will always be contemplating reality as process. This is one way to talk about what Suzukiroshi called that little difference that practice makes, but how crucial that difference is. How it's the dividing line between bondage and liberation, or between misery and peace. Little by little, you get to where anything can remind you of that contemplation, any phenomenon, anything that occurs, either inner or outer, whether it's an explicit Buddhistic exercise like following your breath or something, or just something that happens. Just the mind will turn towards reality. You will appreciate how this body mind, this practice, as Dogen says, always points at the real. This is profound, profoundly gratifying and enlivening. Well, we can probably have our ceremony now. Maybe you have some question or comment. You're always invited to object, you know, if you think I have misstated things or unforgivably distorted Buddha's teaching. You must say so. It's your obligation. Pardon. On the other hand, maybe you're all so into contemplating person as process, you'd rather not have to speak.
I was moved by Dharma talk here this morning. Is going through a lot of the more intense stressors that I've had in my life, and rather than be have the perception of sort of an entity and happening to me, seeing this all as just a process of learning. Mm-hmm. And that shifted sort of the relation, you know, of me versus something, and mm-hmm. just noticing mm-hmm. as I'm going through this whole process, the changes that it brings, and mm-hmm. that it's not me versus something.
Right.
And that's helpful.
Yes. That's helpful. Indeed it is. It that also points to the real. It also points to the real thing. Another way to say that is that, as I know I've said before, there isn't what's happening and then me. The only me is what's happening. There is no other. This is Shakyamuni's profound insight. To live and practice in that way is to be on the way of liberation. Okay, so usually when we have ceremony here, we kind of have to see who's around and what they know how to do before we can actually figure out the ceremony. So I'm not exactly sure. We may have to, maybe we can use the bell this morning. Maybe we can get Jeff, could you hit the densho?
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe Rami or somebody?
Sure.
So I'll go put on my little white socks and go upstairs, and then try to get some people to carry the little handbells. See if we can get a couple of those. And then we'll come down here and we'll do 3 bows, I think. And then make some little offerings. And then chant the magical spell called the Great Compassion Mantra. Chant that, it's pretty short. And then say a little dedication, and then do 3 more bows, and then that'll be it. So if you can stand to hang around for another few minutes, we'll take care of that, and then have tea.